Hello everyone, and welcome to this meeting of the City of Sydney Local Planning Panel. We'd like to start by acknowledging that we are meeting on the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation, and I pay my respect to Aboriginal Elders past and present. And the panel also acknowledges the present Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people who reside within this area. Meeting today to consider the development applications on the agenda, and there are a couple of policy matters towards the end of the agenda. Panel meeting for tonight are myself, Richard Pearson, as the chair. We have Steve Kennedy, Peter Romey, and community representative Amelia Thorpe. Welcome everyone tonight, and please be assured we will be making our decisions tonight on the merits of each application, following consideration of views expressed in submissions and by the people who address the panel tonight. Determinations and any other decisions of the panel will be by a majority of votes of members present at the meeting and entitled to vote. If votes are required, the chair, me, will have the casting vote. And as an important transparency measure, we do, as well as tabling minutes of the meeting, we do put out down there our reasons for making the decisions we make. If we go against an officer's recommendation, we will state our reasons for that. So I also want to let people know clearly that there are what the city calls relevant to memos in relation to items 4 and 5 tonight. So that's where there have been supplementary submissions made in the case of item 5 by the applicant's planning consultant, and the officers have prepared a response to that. That was put on the council's website on Tuesday, and it is available prior to this meeting. And in relation to item 4, which is the Cloud Arch proposal, there was also a relevant to prepared in relation to that in relation to the submissions on the application. So anybody who's interested particularly in those two items, please make sure you have the memo, which is called the relevant to memo. I think they're green. Maybe they're not anymore. They're not. In terms of public presentations tonight, the format for the meeting is the following declarations of conflicts of interest by panel members. The acting manager planning assistant will provide a view of each application that is going to be considered by the panel, key issues raised, and the recommendations of council staff. We will then hear from members of the public who have registered to speak, followed by the applicant and all the applicant's representatives who may like to address issues raised by members of the public. Please note there is a 3-minute time limit for each speaker, and you will get a warning bell at 2 minutes, so please prepare your presentation to cover your major points within that time. Please also remember the panel is aware of the issues raised in submission, so it's not necessary to cover everything in your 3-minute presentation, just the main points you want to bring to our attention, please. Also, after each speaker be heard in silence while they're addressing the panel, and a courtesy and respect be observed throughout the meeting. Please ensure no personal criticism of any speaker or council staff. The panel may ask questions of speakers to clarify our understanding of what is being said. I should also mention that if you are registered to speak, your address will be recorded. All the public meetings of the panel are required to have audio recording saved and uploaded to the City of Sydney website. Decisions made at the panel meeting and audio recording will be made available at the City website as soon as practicable following the meeting, and that's generally within 3 business days. So also please note no recording or filming of this meeting other than the audio recording which is made by Council. After hearing from speakers, the panel will consider and make a decision on each application. Usually in this forum, sometimes we may need to adjourn to consider an item, but we will always come back into the meeting to make our decision and advise us the decision. If in rare occasions the panel considers more information required before making a decision, we may defer our decision for consideration at a later date. So apologies for that lengthy introduction, but it is important that everyone understands how we conduct business in this panel meeting. What I need to do now is move on to declarations of interest. So I have several declarations of interest tonight, and I'm getting another one. So particular order in relation to item 5. Ms. Thorpe has disclosed a less than significant non-pecuniary interest in relation to item 5, the development application for 524 Burke Street, Surry Hills. As she knows, the applicants of their children go to the same school and preschool. They've spoken a few times at school events and say hi on the street, but are not known beyond that. So that's in relation to item 5. In relation to item 7, we have two declarations, one from myself, and I disclose a less than significant non-pecuniary interest in item 7, the development application for 161 Castle Road Street, Sydney, as in 2005, I was part of a consultancy group which provided a briefing to GPT executives on metropolitan planning issues. I received no payment for that briefing and this did not lead to any business for me, and I've done no work for GPT at any time. Also in relation to item 7, Mr. Romy has declared a less than significant non-pecuniary interest as he prepared a conservation management plan for the heritage building known as Legion House, which was used to guide the adaptive reuse of this building as part of the overall ANZ redevelopment project in the early 2000s. Client was Grocon. He had no involvement with the development application for the rest of the site, including the commercial power that is the subject of item 7, nor the applicant. And finally, Steve Kennedy also is declaring less than significant non-pecuniary interest in relation to items 5 and 7. As his practice, he's an architect, has collaborated with the planning consultancy on their projects, but not on either of these projects that are before the panel tonight. So, I'm going to start the meeting now. For that long, lengthy introduction. So, minutes of the meeting of the 9th of May, which I didn't chair, it was chaired by the alternate chair. But those meetings have been posted to the council's website, and what we're doing tonight is noting those minutes which were endorsed by the chair of the 9th of May meeting. There were no matters arising from those minutes. So, thank you everyone for your patience. We now move to the first standard item of the night, which is item 4, development application for the Cloud Arch, George Street, Park Street and Brewer Street, Sydney. We do have a couple of speakers registered, but first I'm going to ask Michael Sue to run through a presentation on the matter before the planning panel.
Thank you, Chair. This development application for Cloud Arch Public Art Sculpture spanning over George Street, Park Street and Druid Street. It's a 58.61 metre high sculptural metal arch spanning over that street intersection. The arch is constructed of steel box girders with a white painted finish, and the application also proposes in-ground and pole mounted spotlights to trace the path of the arch. The application was extended over, notified over an extended period over the Christmas New Year's period. Once the 536 owners and occupiers were notified and 8 permissions were received. This is just an image of the site. The commission raised concerns about heritage impact, design and aesthetic quality, that the proposal has no functional purpose, there's a risk of terrorism and catastrophic failure, waste money, it's not in the public interest, lack of greenery in the city and too many structures, the lighting should be solar powered. Just by way of background, the two buildings, one on the north and one on the south, have already been approved, so the application plan is solid for above ground roof. And also in 2017, Council appointed an external consultant to provide an independent assessment of proposals. This is an aerial image of the site. Some contextual photographs of the existing site. just the plan view of the arch itself. That's the existing approved footing along the north, on, at the north end of the arch adjacent to the PDB. That's the approved footing to the south adjacent to the Woolworth building. Just an image looking north, looking east, looking south, looking west, and these detailed section of how the arch hits the ground on the north, which is the image to the left, outside adjacent to QVB, and to the south, the image on the right. This is an artist's impression of the arch viewed south along George Street. A closer view, you know, along George Street looking south. From the corner park in George Street. Looking east along George Street. Looking north along George Street, including a future proposed for Public Square on the block, which contains the Woolworths. This is the proposed lighting concept. In terms of compliance with key control, being over the road reserve, there are no mandated height controls. In terms of zoning, the site's covered by, affected by 2/3 of an SP2 infrastructure zone and a BA metropolitan centre zone, and public card is permitted on both zones. The proposals are reviewed by Council's Design Advisory Panel earlier this year. The panel has supported the proposal but raised concerns about the lighting of the arches, how the ensuring that the base of the arch was unflooded, the resolution of how the arch hits the ground, the prototyping of the white painted finish under both natural and artificial lighting conditions, and conditions have been recommended to address the concerns raised by the design advisory panel. Other issues were overshadowing the town's doorstep, where a variation has been requested and which is supported. A request to waive the LDP design competition site-specific development control plan requirements, and that's the way it's supported, and the illumination of the cloud arch, which is not supported at this time and to be subject of future application. The application, the recommendation is to agree to vary the shadowing control, waive the defined competition as site-specific DCP requirements, and to approve it subject to conditions.
Thanks, Michael. So look, I do have a couple of speakers listed here. These are both, I think they're both officers from City of Sydney Council. I've got Barbara Flynn and Kim Woodbury. Barbara?
I'm Barbara Flynn, City Centre Curatorial Advisor and External Consultant to the City of Sydney. I'm curator for Junya Ishigami's artwork. Thanks to the panel for the opportunity to speak with you today. I want to speak to 3 points about the artwork itself and who the artist is, the important milestones of commissioning this work of art, and third, the importance of cloud arch to the City of Sydney. The artwork is by visionary Japanese artist and architect Junya Ishigami. Kudos to Council in commissioning a creator so young. He was barely 40 years old and that's when he was selected in 2014 to undertake the commission. His credentials include having his own firm in Tokyo since 2004. He worked prior to that with the architectural firm Fana in Tokyo. He's winner of the Golden Lion Award at the Venice Biennale in 2010. And he has large-scale realized projects to his credit, which include the Kanagawa Institute of Technology in Japan from 2008, Moscow Polytechnic Museum and its Museum Park the surrounding area, and the House of Peace in Copenhagen dating from 2014. Ishigami is widely recognized for putting forward a new conception of architecture. The concept for cloud arch is that a cloud symbolizes openness, symbolizes freedom, that the association with a cloud is also a very modern and contemporary idea associated with cloud computing. For example, all these terms very important to us today. He also sees it as a symbol for the 21st century in the way that the Sydney Opera House was an important symbol for the 20th century. Ishigami chose the location for Clarados, which I think is very important. It straddles the north, south, and east-west axes of the city and has very good sight lines. It's visible from a great distance in all directions. Quoting from the Cartier Foundation, where he has an exhibition now in Paris, he makes a form of architecture that's receptive to all kinds of groups, all kinds of things. At Town Hall Square, he's creating a civic place for people to come together where they can gather in crowds, hang out, enjoy something that will be a new landmark for Sydney. The commissioning process started in 16 May 2011 with different public art strategies that were accepted or adopted by the city. I was appointed in 2012. The City Center Public Art Plan was drafted by myself and unanimously adopted by Council in June 2013. From there, we went on to run a process, a competitive process, that identified Ishigami. We called for expressions of interest. The expression of interest broke all the records for an art project of the city with 365 submissions, artists from 24 nations and many from Australia. Okay. Yeah, we'll finish up. So I think just in summary, what I'd like to say about the work is that it will bequeath to the city a new landmark. It's an attraction in its own right. We've seen how public art is a great gift to cities. It does attract people. It attracts tourist dollars if you want to look at it in a kind of commercial way. And it will probably become a monument, one of the most photographed in the city. Selfies, we see, you know, examples like this in Chicago and many of the main cities in the world. And also, to Sydney's credit, Sydney is now the leader in these sorts of projects in the world, actually without fear anywhere. And I think that's a very important statement to make. It's a little-known fact, and, you know, maybe keep up the good work. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Barbara. And so I've got Kim Woodbury.
Thank you, Chair and panel members. I don't suppose take up too much of your time. I'm mainly here in the representing the applicant in case there's any questions. This is not your usual development application, the type of structure. But just need to say that as the following from Barbara, that this has been well thought out over a long period of time by the city, has pushed about support by councillors or the council on a number of occasions that fits in with our 2030 Community Strategic Plan, which was originally adopted in 2008 and subsequently updated as part of the requirements under the Local Government Act. So it's part of an overall program for public art in the city centre. It's important culturally, socially and economically. I'll take any questions if there are.
Kim, does the panel have any questions of Kim or Barbara? Looks not. So thank you, Kim. Is there any points that panel members would like to make about this proposal? My view, I received some supplementary advice from staff tonight in relation to the strategic planning basis for this proposal, which I think is considerable. I mean, there has been the city art plan, public art plan, as well as the sustainable Sydney strategy. And as I think Kim mentioned, there's been many years of planning of this proposal. So our job as a panel is to assess the environmental impacts of what's proposed and whether the mitigation measures proposed are acceptable. I know there's been considerable consultation with the state on both the transport, particularly the transport authorities, in determining the conditions for the proposal. So I'm quite comfortable with what's proposed and how it's recommended to be conditioned, including the fact that lighting of the artwork will require separate approval. So on that basis, I'm happy to recommend that the panel adopt the officer's recommendation to approve the application subject to the conditions recommended. All in favour, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, adopted unanimously. Thank you very much. And now we move to item 5, which is the proposal in Burke Street, Surrey Hills. So anyone who is interested in item 4, thanks for your attendance. And I will ask Michael Su to present on item 5. Thanks, Michael.
Just a development application for 524 Burke Street, Surrey Hills. It also has a rear lane to Olivia Street. It's for alterations and additions to a heritage listed terrace, including internal alterations, rear roof extension, a basement, a pool, and a garage and studio above adjacent to the laneway. It's recommended for approval subject to conditions. It was notified from the 19th of December to the 10th of January earlier this year. 270 owners and occupiers were notified and 2 submissions were received. The submissions raised concerns about excavation and loss of privacy. The submissions were received from the immediately adjoining properties to the north and to the south. This is an aerial view of the site. A photo of the Burke Street frontage. The site itself is immediately behind a tree. The Olivia Lane building. And this is the rear of main terrace. And this is a conceptual photograph showing the rear of the terrace for the immediate neighbours. This is the plan of the basement. To the right is Olivia Lane and to the left is Burke Street and north is to the top of the page. This is the ground floor plan. The first floor plan. Second floor plan. The third floor. And the top of the building, the attic level. That's an elevation of Burke Street. An elevation from Olivia Lane, the northern side elevation, southern side elevation, a cross section through the site. These are internal elevations of the back of the terrace, which is the image to the left, and the back of the garage structure, which is the image to the right. In terms of background, back in 2010, there was a similar application approved for the above ground roof. Later on, through Amendment Number C, there was a proposed basement under the plane dwelling. This was not supported by council. And the current application seeks a new basement under the rear yard and under the proposed garage structure. This is a cross-section of the 2010 approval. A cross-section of the refused application proposing a basement under the main dwelling. And this is the current proposal. The height control is 9 metres, but the proposed is 14.824 metres. It does not comply, but on balance, the height control is supported. In terms of floor space ratio, it complies with core control. In terms of some of the development control, the DCP control, there's a height and story control two stories. It's proposed at four. It doesn't comply, but from an officer's point of view, it's supported. In terms of open space, it complies. In terms of style of access, it's considered to be acceptable. In terms of deep soil, the control requires 15%, which is approximately 28 square metres. As proposed, it's approximately 8 square metres, which is 4%, and it does not comply. In terms of the garage height, the control requires 5.4 and it's complied. The main issues are the basin excavation and lack of deep soil planting, the height of the fine and privacy. In terms of the basin, the council's view that proposal limits the provision of deep soil, it's recommended that the extent of basin be contained under the proposed garage structure and deep soil equal to 50% of the site, and a tree to be provided in the rear yard. And this image illustrates where it's recommended space be restricted to. In terms of height, as noted earlier, it exceeds the control, but the height and bulk is consistent with previous approval. The roof addition is compatible with the council control's rear roof extension. There's no significant amount of the impact resulting, and therefore the variation is supported. In terms of privacy, it's noted that screens have been provided and a skill gate has been provided through a rear roof extension. Screens have also been provided to the studio above the garage. This is an image of the rear of the existing dormer window, an image of the rear of the garage as it looks back towards the centre of the site. You'll notice that there's batting screen proposed at 400 mm, and it's recommended for approval subject to conditions.
Thank you, Michael. We had three speakers tonight on this matter. Start with Alex Starr.
My concern was primarily about overseeing, overlooking, and in particular the privacy issues which would come about if the dormer window was not obscured. The information that I had initially was that the dormer window would actually have adjustable louvers, and they were in perfectly distinct clear glass. I've just been informed that that's been updated, and the louvers are now fixed, and they are opaque, and that they are aluminium. Consequently, the issue which I had, which would be the clear vision of someone in our bath or in our shower, is now, I think, addressed with the fixed opaque louvers. So I, as a consequence, I would draw my objection.
Thank you for that, Alex. So now I have the applicant and her planning representative, so I'll send her on in to speak first, please.
Good evening, thank you for your time. My name is Ben Cahoyne, the owner of 54 Burke Street. When we purchased this house, we knew it had a fraught history with neighbours and council, a history of litigation, negative media exposure, local police attendance, AVOs and the DA that we thought was unsympathetic, both to the heritage site and its neighbours. We began our design process seeking to mitigate what had been done before. We did not skimp on imagining what we could do with this home. We paid three renowned boutique architecture firms to specialise in residential homes, tried to buy a partner from Tentar Little, $10,000 each to compete to come up with a design idea. We chose Ten Cow Little because they respected the heritage and site conditions, and they came up with an incredible solution we think is going to be amazing to live in. We engaged our neighbours and sought their feedback and remained open and transparent all the way. We've proposed a new architectural design which removes many problems for the neighbours, such as the approved internal lift and the approved external stairwell, which looks right into the neighbours' houses. When we were designing the backyard, we could see that people along the street had used all their space in varying purposes. For example, the neighbours directly next door have a pool and paved area which covers 100% of the yard with zero exposed soil. Therefore, we never imagined that soil would be specifically targeted as a potential problem in our backyard. We have a growing family of three children, girls aged 4, 6 and 8. Our intention is for our family to be in this house for at least the next 20 years. So it's important that we're designing a space for the long term. This means accommodating teenage years, areas for study, homework and library space. We're a musical family with a piano and guitars and a plethora of other instruments. My oldest two daughters are developing into teen gymnasts, which will require practice equipment. And we're starting to enjoy camping as a family, and I'd really love to have a space to store our camping gear other than the boot of our car. Living on Burke Street will give us an amazing access to the bike path for all of us to ride all of our 5 bikes. I cater for Andy's office lunches, which requires catering equipment. Andy's run his own business for 27 years, and it's important for him to work at home and have space for that as well. This is the house where we expect to utilise every space. For about 10 years, the wine industry was a big part of Andy's clients, and the renovation that we did at 27 Nixon Street includes a large 38 square metre wine cellar which stores 3,000 bottles of spoiled wine, which is why we need storage under the house as well. We have no family in New South Wales, and all of Andy's family and Victoria and mine are overseas, so it's common for us to have other family members stay with us as well. This is not just a house for a family of five, but also a house that accommodates people staying with us for 3 to 4 months at a time. We do not live an isolated life, but we are very welcoming, open house and family-style environment. Oh, almost finished. We embrace the village aspect of living in Surry Hills, and we're renowned for bringing people together. At our current house around the corner, we host many barbecues and dinner parties for friends, and we bought this house with specifically that in mind. We've budgeted to execute the renovation of this house to high standards, and we're looking forward to commencing work building our family home so we can enjoy it to the fullest and fill it with love, laughter, happy memories for many years to come. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator. So I'll ask Stephen Kerr to address the panel. And if, Stephen, if there are specific changes that the applicant is seeking to the recommended consent, that I think we just need to hear what the specifics might be.
Certainly. Thank you, panel. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this item. As I trust you've seen from my letter of last week, we request that the panel delete proposed conditions 2A, 2B and 2C from any consent that they issue. In essence, we believe that the proposed conditions, which require the applicant to increase the amount of deep soil on the site, set the basement walls away from the side boundaries and plant a tree, are unreasonable and or unnecessary. In my letter, I provided examples of recent development applications approved by the panel which demonstrate that strict adherence to the DCP deep soil requirement is unreasonable in the current circumstances. The relevant information memo from council might say that the examples were subject to a different section of the DCP because they were for residential flat buildings and mixed-use buildings. But the fact is that those sections of the DCP required a provision of a certain amount of deep soil, which wasn't provided. According to the memo, the absence of deep soil on these sites was deemed acceptable because of the previously existing development. This is no different to this application, where the existing amount of deep soil is less than the DCP requirement. As such, it should also be deemed adequate justification. If there is any doubt that the same approach is not taken for dwelling houses and terraces, I would refer the panel to development application 2012 flat 367, which was for alterations and additions to a terraced house at 378 Moore Park Road in Paddington, or application 2018/35 for the construction of a garage with first floor office at 48 Cook Road, Centennial Park. In both cases, the applicant was not required to increase the existing amount of deep soil on the site to bring it into conformance with the DCP. In fact, the issue wasn't addressed at all in the assessment report. As centrist has observed, very limited and often no deep soil is common on terraced lots. In my letter, I suggested that the deep soil control of only 5 lots over 150 square metres was inequitable. I appreciate that you can't reconstruct controls to suit the circumstances of a particular application, but it goes to my point that the control is unreasonable and unnecessary in the circumstances of this application, where the area of the site is only 184.4 square metres. The purpose of a DCP, according to the Act, is to provide guidance. A DCP is not a statutory control, and therefore the panel has discretion as to whether or not it should be applied in the circumstances of a particular application. There are ample grounds for the panel to exercise that discretion, as has been done in the past. I mentioned that the existing deep soil on the site is less than the DCP requirement. The actual area is 11.9 square metres, or 6% of the site area. Under the proposal, the deep soil area is 9.5 square metres. However, the applicant will be prepared to adjust the basement design to ensure there is no net loss of deep soil on the site. We have prepared a plan showing how this would be achieved if that is useful. Finally, one of the conditions also requires the basement wall to be set back 500 mils from the side boundary. The project engineer is available with us this evening to answer any questions from the panel. However, we maintain that the setback is unnecessary and that the very carefully considered construction methodology detailed in the report that accompanies the application and the preparation of the dilapidation report before works commence is sufficient to protect the amenity and the interests of neighbouring property. Thank you.
Does the panel have any questions of Mr. Kerr or points that?
You just mentioned that there was a proposal for a change to the basement. You just said we're prepared a drawing. Has that drawing been provided to council?
The difference from what you requested in words, which is, you know, sort of to retain it, like what is different about what the revised proposal compared with what your thoughts approval for?
In effect, it reduces the length of the basement by 350 mil and rearranges the paving. That's what that results in is an additional 2.4 square metres of deep soil area on the site, which brings the deep soil area up to what currently sits on the site.
Look, sorry. I mean, my view is you should have put it in on Friday and then the staff could have made an assessment of it and then we could have considered it tonight. It's very difficult on the spot to be able to get the views of council staff, is my view, but I'll put it back to Steve, who raised the point of Richard.
I think we've made it. If it's 350 millimetres, it's past the thickness of the base wall, so we can understand the implications of that. A quick question about soil equipment for servicing. Is that happening in the basement? I think it's not done anywhere, so I can see. Mm-hmm.
Any other comments from panel members? Pete. Okay, so Steve, thank you very much for that. What we now need to do as a panel is to, I think Mr. Roney has got some points that he wanted to make, so I'll pass it over to him.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted to vary a couple of conditions, not the ones that you were referring to, the heritage conditions, but I don't think you have a problem with it. Just for information, I'm proposing to omit condition 21C, which is the condition that requires new services to be surface mounted rather than chased into existing wall given the extent of interventions to the interior of the building, the fact that there's not a lot of sewage established there, that condition is really not required. And the other condition is condition 21F, which refers to new windows and doors where you're actually undergoing conservation. I'm suggesting that the new windows and doors insert within original openings on existing buildings must match the original material and insert and glazing pattern of the original. So that's just a slight tweak to get a more authentic outcome in terms of the conservation work for the window. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. So look, what I am going to do with this one is just adjourn the meeting briefly. We're going to convene off-site and we'll come back shortly, so we won't be long. Thank you. Okay, well, thanks for your patience, everyone. So reconvene the meeting. In relation to that item 5, where we asked the panelists prepared making small amendments to the basement footprint. So the condition being drafted at the moment, so we can't determine it right now. Just if you can be patient, we'll deal with it. The next item, the staff will come back in shortly and we'll be able to then explain the condition that we're proposing. So I'm going to move now to, we'll come back to that as soon as we can, but I'm move now to item 6, which I don't have before me. There are no speakers on this item. I do need, Michael, we've moved on to item 6, or are you ready to go on item 5? Okay. So pause on item 6, we'll go back to item 5, Louise, move the room. So, I will ask Michael Sue to read out the proposed changes that the panel will consider in relation to this application. If you could do that, please, Michael.
So besides the changes that Mr. Lowney asked for in terms of condition 21, the other changes relate to condition 2. It's proposed that condition 2A be deleted and replaced with a condition that states the extent of the proposed basement is being modified to delete the proportion of the proposed basement to the north of the pool environment to the west of the garage above, with the balance of this area used to support the soil planting. So just to reread that, to delete condition 2A and replace it with the word the extent of the proposed basement is to be modified to delete the proportion of the proposed basement to the north of the pool line to the west of the line of the garage above, with the balance of this area to be used to support the soil planting.
So Michael, if you keep going.
The second part of condition, the modification is to delete condition 2B. And in terms of the applicant's request about condition 2C, that stays unchanged. Can I also clarify with the panel in terms of condition 3 again? Want to make some changes? So in terms of condition 3, it's proposed to delete the second last paragraph, which begins with the word "in particular," and to replace it with a new sentence that states, "In particular, the report must identify the construction methodology of the basement excavation and demonstrate that the works are able to be carried out without undue risk and impact to adjoining property and manage dewatering." So that's simply to replace the third paragraph that begins with the word "in particular" with a new sentence. "In particular, the report must identify the construction methodology of the basement excavation and demonstrate that the works are able to be carried out without undue risk and impact to adjoining properties and manage dewatering."
Thank you, Michael. Look, so it's hard to, it would be much better if we had the conditions and we could show you the changes on the screen, but this meeting we can't do that. We will look at doing that in the future. Essentially, what we're proposing, though, is a small additional area for the basement, which is easily shown on the plan form and has been, I think, demonstrated to the applicant, and some flexibility in relation to the 500mm setback for the two boundaries, that if you can prove to council satisfaction that it will not have a detrimental impact on adjoining property, you will be able to construct to the boundaries on either side. So that's a minor amendment, but an amendment that I think is obviously trying to respond to some of the concerns that have been raised by the applicant tonight without compromising the adjoining owners. With those proposed amendments, I'm going to ask the panel if they're in support of the proposal, subject to the council staff conditions and with those amendments that Michael has just run through. I've just got a point of clarification from Peter Roman. So Peter, would you like to raise that?
Yes, thank you. Condition B, the requirement for 27 square metres of each floor is removed. I missed it.
It is, and Michael, I think you did make that point. Yep.
We've replaced it with words in the balance of the office with classification A requiring a balance of the area to be used for each floor planting.
Okay, so with those proposed changes to the conditions, are the panel all in favour, say aye?
Aye.
Okay, so with those amendments, carried unanimously, and thank you everyone for your patience and your contribution. So, I now move to item 6, which is development application for 638 King Street, Erskineville. We don't have any speakers on this item, but Michael, if you could just quickly run through what's proposed.
So this is the development council 638 King Street, Erskineville, is to change the use of the existing commercial building to a 9-room boarding house with ground floor cafe and with associated building alterations. It's recommended for approval subject to conditions. It was notified early this year and there was one submission received. The submission was concerned about stormwater and sewage and potential noise and loss of amenities. And the submission was from the property immediately to the rear of the site. This is an aerial view of the site. Existing view on King Street. Existing view of the King Street ground floor. An internal view looking out towards King Street of where the proposed cafe is going to be. The existing open space at the rear of the premises. And the immediate adjoining premises to the north. This is an image of the lower ground floor, which is generally one level below King Street. Ground floor, King Street on your left. First floor, second floor, the King Street elevation, the rear elevation. In terms of compliance with the controls, it complies with the call controls. It does not comply with the mandated motorcycle parking requirements. Some of the bedrooms are slightly undersized, but on balance counts considered to be acceptable. In terms of clear and open space, it complies. As stated before, the issues are motorcycle parking. It's our view that it's not practiced by motorcycle parking to property with single frontage to King Street. It's a location all serviced by a public transport and there are no significant impacts from non-compliance. In terms of room sizes, most rooms comply to minimum sizes. Some living rooms are slightly below. And the communal space required a simple amenity for the occupants. It's recommended for approval subject to condition.
Thank you, Michael. Any questions for Michael on any observations from the panel?
I would just like to have it on record that I think that this application complies with the letter, but not the spirit of the set.
Thanks, Steve. There are no speakers on this item, so and as I guess Steve has hinted, this application is subject to the state planning policy and the controls contained within it, so if it complies with the spirit of discretion that the consent authority has. On that basis, I'm happy to recommend we adopt this. Coming up with this recommendation, approve the subject of the recommended condition. All in favour, say aye.
Aye.
Thank you. Carried unanimous. Item 7, Development Application 161 Castle Road Street, Sydney. We have one speaker. I'm just going to ask Michael again to run us through what's proposed.
This is the ANZ Tower site. It's to remove two voids on level 29 and remove an existing staircase, and as a result it creates an net increase of 35 square metres in gross floor area. It's recommended for approval subject to condition. It was not notified as it's only internal operation. This is an aerial image of the site, some site views. That's a view of the western void, which is supposed to be filled in with the stairs from level 28 demolished. This is the view of the eastern void, also on level 29, with the void filled in and the stairs going up returned. This is the demolition plan. A section showing the area to be demolished in red. A section showing the infield. And the proposed layout. The building as approved through the various approvals has exceeds the floor space ratio, and the most recent approval result in an FSR of 14.51:1. Accordingly, there is a net increase and it does not comply with the control of 12.5:1. And in terms of the increase, counts of course the variation, given that it's a small increase in the context and there are no adverse impacts. It's recommended to approve subject to conditioning.
Thanks, Michael. We have Chris Wilson speaking on behalf of the applicant.
Good evening, Chairman and panel members. My name is Chris Wilson. I'm simply here to answer any questions that the panel members have and endorse the recommendations of the applicant.
Thank you, Chris. Do any panel members have any questions, observations of Chris or Louise or Michael? No, on that basis, I'm happy to recommend approval in accordance with the recommended conditions. All in favour, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Carried unanimously. Thank you very much. Thanks, Chris. Okay, so item 8, Palisade Hotel, Beddington Street, Millers Point. Again, we have a couple of speakers on this item. I'm going to ask Michael again to just briefly run through what's proposed.
It's an application to use the existing footpath outside the Palisade Hotel for footway dining between 11 a.m. and 6 p.m. daily, and to use 85 square metres of an expanded footway area for temporary events, you know, with associated barriers between 10 a.m. and 5 p.m. on 4 days a year, being New Year's Day, Australia Day, and Anzac Day. In Melbourne Cup for up to 30 patrons, standing patrons, which represents for proof subject to conditions. It was notified earlier this year there were 3 submissions received from 2 properties. The concerns raised were noise, intoxicated patrons, outdoor acoustic assessment that were considered before hotel operation, noise from the current hotel operation, hotel not complying with the existing plan of management, action not taken by council when hotel not operated correctly, prior noise complaints, hotel patrons smoking on our veranda, and a timing of application coinciding with nearby vacant properties. This image shows where one of the objectives resides. It's an aerial view of the site. A view of Palisade Hotel looking generally west. Again, a close-up view of the Palisade Hotel at such a footway, for more images. And this is a plan of the area proposed to be used. An image of where the outdoor furniture will be stored after hours. There have been previous applications to use the footway for outdoor dining, but they've either been refused or rejected either because they don't have heritage council approval or because the documentation was unclear. From a heritage point of view, the site is listed on the State Heritage Register and also a heritage item and owned within a conservation area. It's considered to be acceptable from a heritage perspective. The proposed hours are supported, in particularly noting that it's on a 1-year trial, and the proponent, the operator, would have to have a good performance over that trial period for council to consider any renewal of the trial hours. As part of that, if and when the action comes back to renew their application, council liaise to community, setting their views, and also liaise with other authorities such as police to see if there's a history of substantiated complaints or and or non-compliance. On top of that, it's also noted that the land is owned by council, so council also has a landlord role in ensuring that the operators behave well. In terms of the event, the proposed hours are from 10 p.m. to 5 p.m. for those years, and again, this is also recommended on the trial period. Going back to heritage, Heritage Council has provided their support of the proposal on the basis that the outdoor furniture and barriers are removable. This is also supported by Council's In terms of noise, it's considered that the hours are reasonable. They're basically daylight hours. There's a limited number of outdoor numbers. The plan management has been updated to address both the daily and event use, and the police will be required to be notified prior to every event. It's recommended for approval subject to conditions.
Thank you, Michael, and we have two speakers on this matter. I've got Bill Blahos. Yep, Bill, if you come forward, press the button and address the panel, please.
Hey, good evening, everyone. There are two main properties directly opposite the Palisades, and one of them is mine, where I live there with my wife. I'm not against the Palisades, instead of them trying to better their business. I do, however, have a problem when they constantly break their curfew, and maybe without knowing it, show total disregard for their neighbours. Just from Christmas, the Palisades Park generated size of the car block and footpaths for several weeks, diesel fumes, loud noise, working till midnight to accommodate the extra summer patrons and extended hours till midnight. From Christmas, we've had garbage collection, bottle transfers, constantly out of curfew, and there's been up to 7 breaches of each per week. Music speakers are located on the outside balconies or near the open windows, which should have been closed at 8 p.m. Rooftop balcony door constantly open to allow patrons to exit and enter the balcony. Excess music blaring till midnight. No point having the doors and windows closing at midnight when patrons are shouting from the balconies till midnight. The VIP rooms on the upper floors, balcony doors left open after 8 p.m. curfew. Then we have the mass exodus at midnight when patrons leave the hotel, shouting, arguing, making heaps of noise. On the two nights being Friday and Saturday, we are somewhat fortunate to have security guards of the hotel rostered on, asking that our noisy people to move on, but it's too late at this stage. Trying to get some groups to move on takes time, and besides, we are now wide awake. Just last weekend, we shared this experience. If the loud crowd gathers any other day after midnight, we are really in trouble because there's no security to move them on. This tends to happen. We have cars parked right outside our place after midnight, loud music blaring, car doors slamming as the party goers go home after midnight. We typically have up to five cabs parked on Dalgetty Street, which is a no parking area, waiting to take the late goers home. They shout as they hop in their cabs. The time is now after 12:30 and the area is nearly clear. Regarding the trading hours being extended of recent DA, the feedback from approval was that complaints were minimal. Well, considering 95% of the other houses nearby streets, Dalgetty, High, Merriman, currently Baker, the response would be minimal. Parking is becoming a problem with the extra business of the hotel. We now have to park in High Street. Where are we going to park when the 95% of residents move in? The bottom bar, noisy, penetrates through our front doors as though that right next room. Would be great if the windows and doors facing our properties were closed. No doubt we reduce the noise significantly. So where are we now? We want to cram more people into the hotel, even though we can't meet current restrictions. We can't provide pick-up points for patrons. Cabs have to stop in their parking to pick up patrons. The noise is currently disruptive for residents. If we put more people outside during the day, The noise will constantly echo and go right through a specialist two houses officer, which are about 10 metres away. And final point, during our properties are heritage and not designed to reflect noise, and only metres away from the hotel and the proposed seating outside area requested by the Palisades. Whether it's barrels or tables, it won't matter a difference. It won't make a difference. It encourages people to congregate outside and be noisy. So I'd like to think more consideration will be given to the residents when making these decisions, which will no doubt affect the long-term appeals and the outlook of the area. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Any questions of Mr. Vlahos? Okay, Bill, thanks very much. So I've got James Kingston on behalf of the applicant. James, you might want to address some of the issues raised by Mr. Vlahos, if you can. Thank you.
My name's James Kingston. I'm here about the applicant, OAD City Grant Services, who had a plan to put this PA together. I might just briefly touch on some of the points raised by the previous speaker and just start off with some initial clarification. This PA doesn't propose any additional people within the hotel. It's simply a redistribution of the hotel's existing capacity. There are also no additional hours committed. In fact, all of the hours are within hotel's existing operating hours and have been informed by a previous CFAP preparation for the ad. I would also like to draw attention to some mechanisms within the plan of management of the hotel, which establish procedures through which complaints can be responded to. There's an email and there's a system that is up on the hotel's website where complaints can be registered at any time. There's also a 24-hour phone service through which residents are able to contact the hotel and notify them of any of their grievances as they happen. The hotel has also been working closely with council's compliance team to mitigate any impacts as soon as, or any issues as soon as they come to light. In relation to the noise, I'd also just like to point out that the doors are closed every night at 8 p.m. In accordance with conditions under a previous consent. And the acoustic report that accompanied this application found that the outdoor seating of, I believe, up to 40 people couldn't meet the relative noise criteria. This application proposes 12 people in the front area. On the tables and chairs that are proposed in that location, as well as, I believe, 20 to 30 people on the 4 days of the year that are seeking approval for the event. I'm also here with the licensee, a representative of the owner of the hotel, and we are happy to answer any further questions.
Thank you. Any questions of Mr. Kingston? No? Yep, we do.
Clearly there's some sort of mismatch between what we heard from the previous objector and what you were saying about the plan of management being operated by the hotel. Have you anything to add that could clarify that? If we're hearing more saying the plan of management or the Saturday 8 o'clock, as a phone server, we're being very good citizens, we're working hard at compliance. We've got somebody across the road saying lots of things happening. These often are difficult points to make an understanding of what we should allow. Anybody who needs to add, or anybody else to allow?
I think it might be progressive calling it the mechanisms that they have in place to respond and work with the residents, if that's okay.
Look, I mean, the issue of the general compliance of the hotel with the existing consent and operating condition, which is relevant, but primarily tonight what we need to consider is the application before us, I think Steve is right to raise the point. We have an obvious discrepancy between what Mr. Lahoff raised and your view that it's all hunky dory. If there are times when the hotel operates out of alignment with its conditions or events occur that cause issues for the neighbours, then I think it's a matter of, I guess, speaking up and doing better going forward. I mean, probably some of that happens, I suspect. I don't think I've ever been to the Palm Bay Hotel, but it's kind of what happens with Palm Bay, I think. But it's really important if we're going to give you an additional ability to conduct outdoor dining, that you show a heightened level of sensitivity of the neighbours going forward, because otherwise you're going to be back here in 12 months' time, and should we approve this tonight, and we probably would be unlikely to extend it going forward if it comes back into the whole litany of compliance issues. I think that's where it's at. You probably don't need to address it chapter and verse tonight, but that's essentially, I think, where they're coming from as well.
I might just add one thing and clarify that, following on from what I've said before. The plan of management has been amended to include new items and new conditions within it to provide mechanisms to deal with the alterations that are proposed as part of this CA. So obviously, plan of management is conditioned to the CA, and those new mechanisms will be in place to incentive granted.
So that would be how the hotel would be planning to address any issues. Anything else, Steve,
just a quick comment to the applicants. There are any number of clubs around Sydney that have been put through extraordinary complicated and heavy control to allow them to expand their uses and their activities. The rules are extraordinarily strict, and after a period of change, they usually get it, and neighbours become happy. Managing people leaving, doing the right thing by neighbours. Bit of a lecture, but I don't see why the Palisades, which I've been and like, should not be subjected and should not have the attitude that it treats its neighbours in the same manner. And if we are of a view to approve this tonight, it is a trial, and I would suspect it will be monitored pretty carefully.
That's good. We're on a pretty similar page here, I think. I'm happy to recommend that we adopt the officer's report and do give the 12-month temporary consent, and we will be watching closely that it's implemented appropriately and that there is respect shown for adjoining residents, and we'll consider that when we are faced with the renewal application in 12 months' time. So my basis, all in favour, say aye.
Aye.
Okay, carried unanimously. Thank you for your time, everybody. Okay, well, that concludes it doesn't. We have item 9, which is development application in the Queen Victoria Building, 429 to 481 George. Michael.
This relates to Shop 59, which is on the lower ground floor. It's for interim alterations to the existing shop and threatened for approval. It was not notified as it's only internal alterations. That's an image of QBV, where the shop is in relation to its connection to the town floor station towards the right. The existing shop, the proposed shop, the before and after plan, the floor plan elevation. From a heritage point of view, it's acceptable. Signage is also acceptable. And it complies with the QBV design fit-out guide. or was it internal? The subject of the state heritage exemption and no tenant fabric will be affected. Witness for approval subject to condition.
Any new comments?
Just a quick one, Mr. Michael. The compliance with the QDB design guidelines, who does that? Do you do that, or the council do that, or the QDB people themselves?
I understand it's IPO that does that, but we also have a copy, and I'm sure our heritage guys would satisfy themselves that from a purely heritage point of view, the outcomes are acceptable.
Okay. Happy to recommend this. All in favour say aye.
Aye.
Adopted unanimously. Thank you. We have two policy matters. So there is an amendment to the local pain panel operational procedures, and this is essentially to bring in some clearer controls around the relevant to process, so time frame, greater predictability for applicants and objectives, so that and the panel members, so that we're getting early advice about proposed changes supported by the officers, who've been very constructive in responding to the issue that has been raised, and I'm happy to support it with one small amendment, which is to change, actually in the amended operational procedures themselves, but to change by to add the word on the business papers after the word interested party. So we've been very clear that it's late for the business papers, not the submission on the applicants, which obviously made much earlier in the process, so I think they're in here. Understand that small change, and on that basis I'm happy to recommend this amendment. All in favour say aye.
Aye.
Okay, very unanimously, thank you. And then we have item 11, which is local funding panel delegations, and happy to hear views on what's being proposed.
Okay. When I made a comment that I made earlier, I wasn't aware that there is already delegation to the appropriate pieces of the council for interior works to heritage items that aren't owned by council. So now that I'm aware of that, I guess there's a case for consistency. As much as you'd like to think that council would exercise a greater degree of rigour to grade out what's out there, I'm prepared to modify my concern or my predilection to amend that the rest of the recommendation as it stands. For consistency's sake. I mean, it doesn't mean that I don't have some sort of lingering concerns about quite substantial work, which is subject to political pressure by the council on officers, but as it stands, I'm prepared to endorse that the recommendation as it stands.
Peter, and just for the record, what we are attempting to do here is to ensure that this panel deals with the application of substance and that some more minor things are delegated to council staff. And so temporary installations probably are temporary events. And also internal alterations at the buildings for a heritage item, so between Victoria is classic example where we are adding time to determination time frames without actually adding much value in one view. I'm happy to recommend that we support this change to the planning panel delegation, and all in favour say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Very unanimous. Okay, and thank you very much. On that basis, that does conclude the meeting, and thank you everyone, including